Welcome one and all to the Track One Side One podcast. I am your host Gaz Jones, and this episode's guest is the singer from legendary erstwhile Welsh indie punks Bedford Falls, and his name is Tom Willicombe. And this episode, as you'll see, is bursting with stories from teenaged angst in Manchester to Reading Festival nightmares and sawn off crooklocks. Tom's also got game in regards to his song choices that he's put on his personal mixtape for us. So please enjoy, and I'll speak to you later. Cheers.
I feel kind of basic today. Top five side ones. Track ones.
You are listening to the Track One Side One podcast with me, your host, Gaz Jones. Each week, a guest picks their five favourite album opening tracks, and we dissect, discuss, and debate each one. So let's put on our classics and have a little chat then, shall we? And we are live. So in front of me on my laptop screen, all the way down there in Wales, is the lovely Tom Willicombe from Bedford Falls. How are you, mate?
Oh, I'm marvellous, Gaz. Absolutely marvellous. It's a pleasure to hear your dulcet tones and weird mocking accent.
I'd just like to say for the record that I've lived all over the world, so that's probably where it comes from.
I've only ever lived in Cardiff.
Before we start on your list, mate, I was wondering how hard was it getting it down to just five songs?
So with regard to list, two on it are absolute bangers. I started so many like side A, side B's of like mixtapes when I was like in my kind of late teens, probably even into my early 30s, with them, and they were like, you know, they're absolute bangers. They are the cream of the crop. One of them is by my favorite band/artist of all time, and the other one is just one of the most beautiful pieces of music I've ever heard in my life. As far as the other ones were concerned, I mean, like, once you start talking, like I mentioned to you in the email about like 1988, there's a raft of records. Like, I class 1988 as kind of, when people talk about 91 being the year that punk broke, actually like 88 is the year that actually really kickstarts like what we know now as indie rock, because you've got like Sonic Youth, and obviously the first song on Daydream Nation is Teenage Riot, which is an incredible opening song for any album. You've got Bug by Dinosaur Jr. It's got Freak Scene on it as the opening song. You've got like that first Fugazi EP, which has Waiting Room as his first song. Again, an iconic opening track for any album by arguably my second favorite band of all time. You've got Superfuzz Big Muff, the European vinyl version, which is the version I know and love and had, which opens with Touch Me, I'm Sick. So, you know, you've got like a bunch of like literal classic albums, like iconic records with iconic opening tracks. And I have picked an album from 1988, which most people would not regard as an iconic album or track, but it is to me. So,
without further ado, mate, what's the first song you want to talk about?
Well, that'd be Firefly by the American Musical, wouldn't it?
The floor is yours, mate.
It's weird because it's not like my favourite American Music Club song, or like, you know, it's certainly in terms of like songs that they have that like literally, or songs that Mark Eitzel's written in general, not just American Music Club songs, it's certainly not the one that punches me hardest. Like, that Lap Steel hits you and it's like, wow, this is gorgeous. You know, it's a for Eitzel, it's a pretty kind of like light song about like getting fucked up on LSD and sitting outside and watching fireflies, but it's still incredibly beautiful, incredibly moving. And as with, I would say, 90% of the man's work, there are at least two or three lines in there that you're like, yeah, I've lived that. And even if you haven't, you still think you have, because that's what Eitzel does. The best songwriter of my lifetime, beyond a shadow of a doubt.
The thing I always get from this song is that kind of opening lyrical couplet, which is like trying to appreciate the natural beauty for the inevitable end.
You've got to contextualize some of that stuff as well, with like what Eitzel's going through in like AIDS ravaged like San Francisco in the late 80s. By this point in time, you know, he's watched both of his parents pass away, he's watched a shit ton of his friends pass away. His kind of whole sort of perspective of what life is and how you really need to appreciate while you have it. It isn't the most kind of devastatingly emotional song on the record, but as an opening song to kind of lead you in, it's just perfect. To be honest, it's not even the best version of that song, because the version on like the live solo album he did 2 years later is just incredible. In terms of when I think of an opening song, that is what I think of.
I'm just interested in what you're saying about there, like, you know, not being like the best song on the album or the best song that he's ever written. But that's kind of the point of this list. It's about picking those amazing opening songs. It doesn't have to be the best song on the album or even your favourite album by said band or even your favourite band. It's just those incredible opening songs that almost, you know, kind of set out the stall. And like you said, that when that pedal steel guitar comes in at the start, my God.
I was pretty emo as a teen, which probably won't surprise you.
Not at all.
I don't really, like, you know, when emo happened, the bands that are regarded as emo, not including like Rites of Spring, because like shit's incredible, but like, you know, like what people call proper emo, so like mid to late 90s stuff, as a 17-year-old boy, instead of thinking, oh man, it's terrible, because, you know, at that point I didn't even know that Mark Heidsel was gay, but instead of me thinking, oh, you know, AIDS is terrible and, you know, it's terrible to lose people that you love, like, I was just like, oh my god, yeah, oh I can't get a girlfriend. And I think that probably tells you about as much as you need to know about me, that I can equate one man's sort of sense of longing and grief with like my inability to have any kind of like physical relationship. And that literally, like, that was like, that was my 20s as well. I would say almost up to the point that I met like my wife Carrie. It was just, like, that was kind of, yeah, that kind of weird, like, fragile, toxic beta male thing was definitely my brand. Definitely my brand as a young adult.
What are the characteristics that make a great opening track, do you think?
It depends on the album. Or like, I mean, I guess it has to be something that grabs you straight away. Although I will caveat that by saying, and I haven't included them in this, but I quite like the fact on those first two Weekend albums, they start with a really, really slow song and then go into a really, really fast song. So they start an album with a really quiet, slow song and then go straight into a very loud, very fast song. And I do like that, but it's almost like what we were saying off air about like hip hop skits, whereby it's not like, it doesn't feel like that track. Like the opening track needs to be, as much as your band is capable of delivering one, a banger. And as you say, it doesn't have to be the best song on the album or contain the most depth. But what it does need to do is like basically punch your cerebral cortex into being like, this is, what's this? I like this. It just needs to kind of grab you to make you want to listen to the rest of the record.
Track two, mate. What do you want to talk about?
The song is Love Catastrophe by Shudder to Think from the album Get You Go Discord Records. Shudder to Think are a weird band, an incredibly weird band, a deliciously weird band. A band that came out of the Washington DC hardcore scene with a singer whose voice can only be described as operatic, but not in a Bruce Dickinson kind of way. Like a vague sense of androgyny. They sound a bit like Queen, which is odd because I fucking hate Queen. Love Catastrophe is where I come in. It's a weird but moderately funny story that once again hinges on the fact that I was a morose fucking teenager. So we're 2 years on from my introduction to American Music Club. I was introduced to American Music Club in 91. 2 years later, I'm going to look at universities because I'm about to finish my art college foundation course. Me and a bunch of mates bundle together into a car. We drive up to Manchester for like 3 days just to see what Manchester University is like. We stay with this girl. I develop crush on the girl. She's not in a great headspace at that point in time. I clearly am not in a great headspace at that point in time. We go to a place called Eastern Block Records, which I believe was run by 808 State. So we went there, and I had actually listened to Get You Go before. Like, a mate had a copy and brought it around my house, and we listened to it in the background. I wasn't paying attention, but I knew that I liked it, and it was like £3 in their bargain bin. Wow. I think I bought that. I bought Sack Full of Silver by Thin White Rope on clear white vinyl. I think there were three records. I can't remember what the third one was. But anyway, Get You Go comes home with me. We stay up there like this late night. My hormones are absolutely raging. You know, I'm fully leaning in to the sad sack routine that I have already, by this stage, made my own. We come home. It's an exhausting drive home. for some reason, I have the bright idea that we should drive home off the motorway. So basically drive home through North Wales. This proves to be the stupidest idea anyone's ever had. And why anyone would listen to me, a man who, at that point in time, my dad had only just learned to drive himself. No idea what I was talking about. But anyway, we drove home basically through North and Mid Wales, and it took like 13 hours or something moronic like that to get from Manchester to Cardiff. We get home, and I go up into my room, which at that point in time I'm sharing with my younger brother. He goes out to get leathered. I stay in. I drop the needle on Love Catastrophe, and I hear that opening swoon, and I just burst into tears there and then. Like, not even like, I'm not going to say like it's a specific, like it's a very profound moment, because I don't feel like we should encourage teenage Tom any more than he was already encouraged to be overly dramatic. It was just a moment of really crystalline beauty at a point in time when I was just completely vulnerable to that kind of thing. And it just absolutely hit me. The rest of the record is weird and angular and awkward and androgynous and just amazing. But that, just like that opening, like, couple of seconds where he's holding that note is just incredible. And even like, he does it, and then you've got like that, the guitars kind of crash in, and then it pulls back, and you've got the bass, and it's just an amazing piece of work. And the weird thing being, it's like completely changed out like half the band after this record, and got even better. Like, Pony Express record is just probably one of the three greatest rock records of the 1990s. And, you know, when you bear in mind how many incredible rock records came out in the 1990s, like, that album is an absolutely, completely undervalued masterwork.
It's the importance of an opening track on an album as we first knew it, you know, when we were starting to obsess over music, being emotional teenagers, as we both were. Do you think that's something that's been lost in the digital age that we're in?
I don't know, because I still only experience albums the way I've always experienced albums, by and large.
Kind of a second part to that question as well, then. Obviously, being a songwriter, do you automatically know when you've written the opening song of said album? Like, for example, did you know that when you wrote Whose Coat Is This Jacket, for example, or Cunningham, did you know that they were going to be like the first song on the album?
Whose Coat weirdly brings me into one of the other songs on the list. Whose Coat was when I wrote, like, so it's difficult, like, I wrote it a long time ago, so it's kind of difficult to remember, but I believe once it was written, it was, by and large, you find, although not so much on the album that we've just written, certainly with the others, there was definitely a point where we were like, yeah, this is going to be the first song on the album. Like, there is, it was definitely Whose Coat. To a degree, I can't really remember with Cunningham so much. I think Cunningham was just like, we were like, that's the big song on this record. Like, let's just put it first. I don't remember anything yet. I think Cunningham was more because we didn't think there was anything else there that occupied that space. With a third one, I think like Get It Up was always going to be the first. But and again, that ties back into like what I'm going to say about the next song on the list.
Track three, what do you want to talk about?
The unfortunately titled Nickelback by the
The only time Nickelback will ever get fucking mentioned on my fucking podcast.
Short, sharp, like absolutely what I envisage any opening track on like a punk rock record to sound to be like. I don't think it's much longer than a minute, but like it absolutely, it's almost like the start of a car chase where like the second car start and like the wheels are spinning and like everything's a bit chaotic and it's kind of not like it's not quite like holding to the road, it's a little bit all over the shop, like the guitars are just like kind of almost bouncing off one another. It's an amazing opening track, and again, a band that like aren't particularly well regarded by like, you know, fans of that genre, but I think put out like four pretty great records, and if you count the Retasonic album, I'd say five. I think a lot of the time people disregard Blue Tip because Jason Farrell is incredibly beautiful, incredibly talented at pretty much everything he chooses to do. So I think people just don't like him because of that. He basically looks like Jimmy Dean, designs record sleeves like nobody's business. He can skate like nobody's business. He can play guitar like nobody's business. He's an incredible singer, a great lyricist. You know, pretty much everything he's done, I love. It's just, it sounds both tight and chaotic at the same time. It's over incredibly quickly, and you're just like, what just happened there? It's almost like being robbed. It's like being mugged, but like it's like being mugged with guitars.
Even like the lyrics kind of just reek of like chaos, and it's like mm-hmm. a inebriated poet wrapped in metaphors and reeking of desperation and piss.
Yeah, it's great. It's like, you know, you bleed me dry and ask for a nickel back deposit. I mean, what an incredible line.
It's that off-kilter guitar, like I said, it's kind of just like it's crashing around on the bottom of a bin or something. But it's got that kind of, for what I look for in music of that time, really, it's got that like jawbox-like intensity.
It does, but more
succinct, I guess.
It's more succinct. I would say it's probably more intense than jawbox. Like, I think it's just like, it's like an overwound toy. I mean, the line, I never had a headache until I threw down under you. And I'm just like, that almost like, for periods of my life, that was like a mantra to me. And again, possibly me not understanding the lyrics, because I think it always applied to me more in the workplace than it did romantically. The other example I give you is like at the start of a Greyhound race. Like, it's an absolute energizer. And certainly, as I you know, said to you before about like, you know, some of the opening tracks on our record, definitely what I aspired to. You talked specifically about Coat, Whose Coat Is That Jacket. The goal there, once like I kind of put it together, was like the execution was always to be like a cross between Blue Chip and Leatherface. And I think, to be honest, the closest I've ever come to a mission statement in any song that I've ever done, and I think we actually managed to crack it. I think it does kind of hit, like, it kind of has that combination of like the slight chaos and the speed and the kind of venom, like, of Nickelback, but also has like the kind of like more chiming sort of focusedly melodic sort of guitars of like what Leatherface were doing. Like, obviously that comes from Hooskadoo as well, which is,
I think you got the balance perfectly right with that song, to be honest. I mean, it was the first Bedford 4 song I ever heard, and I was in. Do you still enjoy listening to an album from start to finish?
Yeah, I listened to Goat earlier on, speaking of great opening tracks on an album.
It was its anniversary today, wasn't it?
It was yesterday, yeah, 30 years.
Yesterday.
I mean, you can't, like, again, as far as, like, songs that are effectively mission statements for a band, Then Come Dudley by the Jesus Lizard is pretty much as great an example of that as you will ever hear. Like, and, you know, that whole album, like, start to finish is, I would say, almost like the platonic ideal of what a rock band, if you strip like any kind of like emotive value for, like, so there's no real kind of resonance there, like kind of melancholy or like any of the things that normally I kind of feed off in music. But in terms of just sheer, you know, Sturm und Drang, that record has it all in spades. And it isn't even like that, like, kind of loud in terms of the guitars are very super clean, but like that bass tone absolutely crushes, and those drums add, like I was reading a review of it today, and it said that like the snare sounds like a slap in the face, and it absolutely does. Again, an incredible opening song for an incredible album. And it definitely does do that kind of thing where it like grabs you by the scruff of the neck and goes like, this is what we are, this is what we do, and this is like what we're going to do to you for like half an hour, 35 minutes.
Track 4, mate.
All right, we'll go for Nas, NY State of Mind, which you class as the opening song. I can only think of one hip-hop record that has a better, for want of a better term, opening track, and that's going to be It Takes a Nation of Millions. And again, 1988, another classic from 1988. And Bring the Noise, I don't know, it was to a degree, that was a kind of coin toss for me between Bring the Noise and NY State of Mind. And I think it was just purely the fact that, like, I just think the lyricism that Nas delivers on NY State of Mind, like, something that I don't think he tops NY State of Mind on the Illmatic, much less on any of the other absolute pony records he's put out since. You know, like, Nas is a very, like, there was a brief spate in the mid-90s of like artists who promised much and delivered very little. After that first wave of like Woo records, like, I like, they pretty much ran out of gas after Liquid Swords for me. And to be honest, never really got on with, like, Brooklyn Zoo, Only Built for Cuban Links, and again, this isn't going to get me any friends here. Like, I never really, like, that didn't really do a great deal for me either. So, yeah, like, that Illmatic for me, like, his flow on that record, specifically on NY State of Mind. I mean, there's so many quotable lines. I never sleep because sleep is the cousin of death. Like, who doesn't feel like that at some point in their life? It's just, like, that, like, even if the only lyric Nas ever dropped was, I never sleep because sleep is the cousin of death. And, you know, looking at his career, it might just as well have been. I kind of fell off hip hop towards the late 90s, early 2000s for the reasons that the reasons I kind of I gave just now. It just felt like no one had any level of consistency beyond like Public Enemy, really. And even they kind of fell off a little bit at that period of time. There are outliers, like I really like that Jurassic 5 album, although the second album wasn't that great. Like, there is stuff that I'm now aware of that I like from that time, like Company Flow and like MF Doom and stuff. But I think, like, I listened to so many disappointing hip hop records between like 97 and like 2000 that, like, it just soured me on hip hop as a genre. Not that I can't hear stuff that I really appreciate now when I hear it. Like, I listened to like Denzel Curry's new record last year, and that was amazing. And I listened to like Lady Nokia, she's great, but that was kind of those two records were like the first two new hip hop records that I'd listened to in years, probably since MF Doom, because it just doesn't come across. Like, there's a line in the Mark Eitzel solo album Notes that I referred to earlier on, like his first live album, and it says, when a creature stops evolving, they over specialize and like from the early 2000s, I really, really over specialized in indie rock. Like pretty much every possible flavor of indie rock, by and large. If it's being made by white people with guitars, or sounds like it's being made by white people with guitars, it's pretty much all I listen to. And that appalls me, especially like the me from like 1993 to 2000, who was like literally, I want to listen to everything. I want to absorb everything. But I also kind of got to like that point in the early 2000s where I was like, by absorbing like lots of music outside of like my kind of my zone, like I missed a lot of like absolutely great stuff in my zone. Like, I never got to see Superchunk in the 90s. I never got to really listen to Superchunk. Arches of Loaf, I didn't truck with. Like, there's loads of bands that are now like amongst my favorite bands of all time that I just didn't get round to in the 90s because I was buying like Guru and Jazzmatazz records. And let me be brutally frank with you, Gaz, there's a Fun Loving Criminals album in my album collection. Yeah, what's the one with the black cover where they're riding the car on the front?
Yeah, Come Find Yourself. Scooby Snacks.
Yeah, terrible, terrible record. And I feel like my kind of my like 90s eclecticism almost led me to new metal. Although I will say this, that first Doggy Dog album,
it's fucking great.
I still think that album's great. I know it's not like music I should like, but I really like that record.
One of the best Reading sets I ever saw was Dog Eat Dog in about 97.
It would have been 97.
They were fucking great. It was on the second stage. They were fucking great.
I didn't go that. That was the first year I didn't go at all. So I went 1990 through 95, went to 96, had to come home on the Friday because I contracted flu on the Thursday night. I had to drive home as well in a fucking like a full on storm. I could hear seaweed playing from the main stage. My mate broke the key to my crook lock in my car door, so we paid the AA to come out, and I wasn't an AA member, so I had to join. So he charged me like 200 quid or whatever it was there. And all he did was hack sort of fucking thing off. We were around the corner from a bloody hardware store.
Wow.
So track five then, Black Sabbath. Black Sabbath, Black Sabbath from the album Black Sabbath. Say what you like about this probably came as a moderate surprise to you because you know I fucking hate metal. But one, Black Sabbath were purely transcend, like certainly first four albums Black Sabbath. Not only does it transcend the concept of metal, they fucking invent an entire genre of music. The first song on the first side of their first album. They invented a genre of music, and they don't even really go back to that until Paranoid. So the rest of the album is like dark, thick tone of Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath for the rest of the first record. I mean, definitely by Masters of Reality, they're in it, and they kind of know this is what people like from us. But yeah. I would say they're not really hitting like full on metal until Masters of Reality. It's nowhere near my favorite Black Sabbath song, but like literally, it revolutionized. It revolutionized music. They didn't even know it at the time.
No, not at all.
Like, it's like I say, they don't really, because obviously they were literally writing albums like at a fair old clip. They don't really understand what, like, how big an impact what the song Black Sabbath had until like album 3. You can definitely say War Pigs kind of has that kind of tritone thing that like Black Sabbath has. You can definitely say that Iron Man's got it as well, but Paranoid is like, it's a stomper. Paranoid is more akin to something like the Stooges or Alice Cooper. And then you've got like, you know, the jazz rock odysseys, and again this shit, like even on like the kind of the metal stuff on those first two records, War Pigs definitely veers into jazz. Their background as a jazz band is all the way through like their first, like the first four records. And that's what makes them amazing. And it's kind of, it's only really like towards like the mid to late 70s that they really start to codify that, and it gets a little bit dull. And then, you know, as soon as like Gillan and Ronnie James Dio are kind of doing the Air Raid siren shit over the top of it, it's, you know, it definitely, like, I'm not gonna like slate like the Dio records. They're not my bag, but like they're still Black Sabbath and they're still pretty tasty. But it isn't what I want from, like, it isn't something I'm going to sit down and listen to, like, over and over again the way, like, both the early Aussie records are.
No love for, like, Sabotage?
It's only fairly recently that I listened to a Black Sabbath album that wasn't either this weird best of comp that I had that was just basically a kind of comp of the first four records, and, like, Paranoid, which I've had on vinyl since I was a kid. Like, I've always liked Sabbath, like, even when I started getting into punk, I liked Sabbath, but, like, legacy stuff has never really driven me, particularly. Like, there aren't a lot of legacy artists that I like enough to listen to more than, like, a couple of records. Sabbath is one, Neil Young's probably the other, Big Star only had three records, so, you know, and I don't really like third. So, it's just, I've got, like, I think it was because I came up like reading like The Melody Maker and The Enemy. It gives your focus towards like the future, and even now, even though obviously like I'm a middle-aged man, definitely, you know, I'm in my mid to late 40s now, you know, I play in a fairly retrograde rock band that definitely references the music of my youth. Like, my interest in actual kind of rock music of the time, you know, I like music that is more interesting than like just like straight up like guitars, feedback. I still fucking love all that shit, don't get me wrong, but you know, I like, you know, probably my favorite current band is the band Wyoke, who are a very kind of, you know, an incredible band with a very broad sonic palette. My favourite record of last year was by a fellow called Barty Strange, which is, again, a complete genre buster of a record. Probably, like, the most eclectic record I've listened to in 20 years. You know, it's got hardcore, it's got, like, funk, it's got R&B, it's got everything. Like, it's almost like somebody took all the records I liked from the year 1993 to the year 1999 and squeezed them all in. And then, like, just, like, just dropped a little bit of trap over the top of it. It's like it's absolutely incredible. So yeah, but like back to Sabbath, it's like they were, you know, they literally invented an entire genre of music pretty much within the first 30 seconds
of
their first album. Like, metal doesn't really transcend what they did. Nothing is metal until Sabbath.
No. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I was going to, you know, there's kind of like suggestions and inflections of bands before then and stuff. But yeah, it was year zero was Black Sabbath with, you know, with the pouring rain and the tolling bell. And it still sounds like the oral equivalent of a horror movie. considering, you know, even though it's like over 50 years old now, I don't think its power has been diminished.
No, it certainly hasn't.
Certainly that song, it's, you know, it's mad, really, you know, how many hundreds of times I've heard it, and I still get a little bit of, a little kind of fizzy teenage kick hearing it now.
Well, it's those, it's those tritones. Nobody had really done that in, like, in popular music at that point in time. Like, obviously, like, it comes out of, to a degree, like, classical, I guess.
Yeah,
like,
it was Venus, God of War, isn't it?
Yeah, Venus, God of War, So it's kind of like, it's got a precedent, but not in popular music. And then it all takes, like, this, like, kind of, like, you know, loath as I am to bring the old Nazi up, this Wagnerian sort of, like slant, you know, like, and again, I think that's where metal, like, certainly, like, bands like Priest and stuff kind of picked up on. And that's where I kind of sign out, like the Sturm and Drang and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm not saying, like, I hate every single metal band. Like, there's definitely metal I like, but certainly, like, none of it I like as much as Sabbath, with the possible exception of the first four Danzig records. But again, Danzig or rock band. Danzig just sounds like Roy Orbison singing over AC/DC.
Yeah, or like the electric era Cult. Especially on that first album. I know that was probably a lot to do with Rick Rubin.
Like, I should hate Danzig because...
Yeah, you should, yeah.
Like I really hate all that, like, goofy horror movie shit. Like, the kind of... The more, like, the old theatrics. But, like, shit, the way John Christ plays guitar on those records. It's the band. Like, to be honest, like, as great as Glenn's voice is on those records...
It's all about it's about the rhythm section, the riffs, and the way it's played. And...
It's all about Rick Rubin's production more than anything else.
Especially on the first album.
And nowhere is that proved more than every other album Danzig has done since.
Yeah, true, yeah. Tom, that's been a fucking lovely chat.
You take care, guys. You stay too, safe, brother.
Speak to you soon. Take care, man. And there you have it. Tom was one of my absolute favourite songwriters, and it was a total honour to have a nat with them on the podcast. And I hope you all enjoyed it out there. Who knows? Maybe you've discovered your new musical obsession. So take care of each other out there. And I'll catch you all on the flip side. Adios.
I feel kind of basic today. Top 5 side ones. Track ones.
You've been listening to the Track 1 Side 1 podcast with me, Gaz Jones. Give us a follow on all the social medias at Track 1 Side 1 Podcast to keep fully up to date with all future episodes and guests, where there will also be links to Spotify playlists that will accompany each show, so please check them out, and I'll see you soon.